here this morning. Thank you if you're visiting. We're just so glad that you're here. We hope we make you feel welcome because you are. You're our honored guests. And to our family here, thank you for being here. You encourage me. You encourage one another. I'm glad for the time that we have together. And I'm thankful for those who've led us in worship so far this morning. Thank you for Kason and reading the scripture. Thank you for Barrett and leading the songs and our thoughts before the Lord's Supper. Larry and Dave and Rodney and leading us in prayer. I've already gotten a great deal out of this service, and I pray that we can continue that with the things that we study here this morning. Would you turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 9? Ecclesiastes chapter 9, and we'll read verse 11 here in just a moment. It'll take a little while for us to get there. We'll reference a number of other passages before we do, but that'll be the first scripture to which we'll turn and read this morning. Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 11. There was a recent poll of hundreds of college students who were asked, if you could ask God any question, what would it be? Number one on the list of the questions that they replied was this: why is there so much suffering in the world? I've been asked this morning to answer that question in a lesson. I'll do my best to provide an overview, but you're going to have to go back and read and study and pray and meditate for yourself on these biblical answers to suffering. The question is worded by these college young people, why is there so much suffering in the world? But may I suggest that it isn't really the amount of suffering in the world that we generally have a problem with, but instead it's the type of suffering. There are some types of suffering the vast majority of us, not just Christians, but the world, are not just okay with. We're actively approving of that kind of suffering. You think about the Hitlers of the world, murderers and rapists and child molesters. Most don't have any problem with them suffering for the things that they do. There is a justice to that. And we might disagree on the specifics of how they should suffer, but we feel that there should be some consequences to these immoral actions, those sins, to put it in religious terms. And I think that hits at some sort of objective standard to morality, but we'll have to save those thoughts for another lesson. And so our problem is not with suffering in general, that there is suffering in the world, or even that there is a lot of suffering in the world. Our issue is with what we view as unjust suffering, specifically. And whether it's a little or a lot, that's what bothers us. May I suggest that there is a general answer given by Christianity? And you might not like the answers that I give this morning, but hear me out, please. Because at the very least, Christianity has an answer that fits with the reality that we see. I would summarize the answer to this question, why is there so much suffering in the world, this way? Because we have free will in a fallen world. That's why there is so much suffering in the world. But we need to be more specific than that. So let's unpack these two concepts, free will and a fallen world, as we consider six causes of suffering that we see in the Bible. The first half of the explanation is found in that concept of free will. If you're going to have choice, you've got to have choices, right? In this case, good or evil, right and wrong. And if you choose evil, you will have suffering in the world. What are the specific causes of suffering? Well, my sin, my choices might cause my suffering. I go out drinking, I drive drunk, I wrap my car around a tree, I cause my own suffering. But the sin of others, their choices might cause my suffering. Someone else goes out drinking and drives drunk and crashes their car into mine. They caused my suffering with their sin, with their choices, because of their free will. And may I suggest that those two points are so incredibly clear that we don't need Bible verses to tell us that, though there are many that we could find if we needed to. The problem comes when it isn't so crystal clear, where there isn't that one-to-one direct relationship. A causes B. Here's the sin, here are the consequences to that sin. For instance, when a child who has done nothing wrong contracts cancer or some other incurable disease, or a good person living a righteous life dies in a freak accident, from where does that kind of suffering come? Well, we can trace this kind of suffering certainly to Satan. There are lots of passages. Let me just give you an example from the Gospels, Acts, the Epistles, and Revelation, just to show that this is a constant theme in the New Testament. In Luke chapter 13 and verse 17, there is a woman of whom Jesus says, Satan has bound her for 18 years. Satan is the cause of her suffering. In Acts chapter 10 and verse 38, Jesus went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, it is said in that sermon. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 through 10, that we'll turn to here in just a moment, Paul's thorn in the flesh is called what? A messenger of Satan to buffet me. In the book of Revelation, in the second chapter, in verse 10, the church in Smyrna there, they are warned that some of them are going to be thrown into prison and caused to suffer by the devil. We know that Satan is a cause of suffering in our world. But may I suggest that time and chance sometimes causes suffering? Are you there in Ecclesiastes chapter 9? Would you read verse 11 with me, please? I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of much skill. Now, what's he saying there? Sometimes the race is to the swift. A lot of times it's to the swift, right? As a slow white boy, I can attest to that, right? I'm not winning a lot of races. Nor the battle to the strong. Sometimes the strong usually wins in battle, but sometimes they don't. The bread to the wise. Sometimes the wise die in the gutter somewhere. Or riches to men of understanding, or favor to men of skill. Usually that's the case, but not always. And that's the preacher's point. He says, but time and chance happen to them all. There's not always a one-to-one relation to things, and sometimes we can't trace back the source of these sufferings. One of the religious platitudes that people say when they don't know what to say, I try to have patience with this because I know sometimes we just grasp at straws because we don't know what to say. But sometimes people say, everything happens for a reason. Everything doesn't always happen for a reason. God sees all, and God knows all. But sometimes He just allows the natural world to function naturally in its corrupted, cursed state. Time and chance happen to us all. And sometimes things just don't work out. And it's not really anyone's fault. It's just the reality of the world in which we live. Which brings us to the fifth cause of suffering, a fallen world. All of this can be traced back to the reality of free will in a fallen world. That's the second part of the equation of our answer. Yes, there is free will, but it is free will that plays itself out in this world, in a fallen world. Suffering sometimes comes not as the result of specific choices, but as a result of living in a world that is dealing with the consequences of sin itself. A fallen, cursed world, once, but no longer perfect. In Genesis chapter 3, after Adam and Eve sinned, God says to Adam, among His curses, cursed is the ground for your sake, in verse 17. This world has been cursed by God as a result of sin. Philip Yancey rightly said, some other religions try and deny all pain or rise above it. Christianity starts, rather, with the assertion that suffering exists and exists as proof of our fall. One may dismiss the Christian explanation of the origin of suffering, that it was introduced into the world as a consequence of man's aborted freedom, as being unsatisfactory. But at least the concept of a great but fallen world matches with what we know of reality. A reasonable person, I believe, looks at our world, the world in which we live, and sees that it is too great to be formed by chance. But at the same time, it is too broken to be the final and perfect work of a perfect God. The answer is explained in the Bible. This world was once perfect, described by our Creator as good, very good. But it is now fallen from that state. And it retains many qualities of its original splendor, But it is broken enough to remind us that this is not how things were meant to be. This is not the perfect world that God created. And we live in a world of wonder that occasionally returns inexplicably cruel. That matches the reality of what we experience every day. A fantastic roller coaster of life that always is about to fly off the tracks. We are Alice, down the rabbit hole, through the looking glass. This is Wonderland. And as wonderful as everything isn't quite right either. You think of the eye. That's often used as proof of God. And the eye is wonderful. Its intricacy, the fact that you can't break it down its parts any further than where it is and have it function correctly. What a confirmation of God's design the eye is. And yet, as great as the eye is, as wonderful it is as it is, sometimes we go blind in this world. In Romans chapter 8, if you turn back there with me, Romans chapter 8, verse 18, I think Paul is addressing this very concept. Paul confirms this line of thinking in Romans chapter 8, beginning in verse 18, when he describes our hope in suffering by comparing it with the suffering of this creation. In doing so, I think he confirms what we already know by our own observation. The creation was subjected to the same kind of frustrations that we are, wonderful but broken. And the consequence is our suffering, which we cannot ignore. Romans chapter 8 and verse 18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which is to be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God, our perfecting. For the creation was subjected to futility, frustration, maybe your translation says, not willingly, but because of Him who subjected it in hope. This was not what God wanted or intended. This was not what the creation certainly wanted. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption, the bondage of decay, that things break down, that things don't work right, into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans with labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, we also have the first fruits of the Spirit. Even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. We look at our bodies, and as wonderful as they are, they break down, they suffer, and eventually they die. And as that breaking down process, that suffering takes place, we who are Christians eagerly wait. We groan for the exaltation of this body, the glorification, to where we are given a spiritual body that doesn't wear down, that doesn't break. And he compares that to this creation that once was perfect, that once like us in the garden was perfect, but has been subjected to frustration and futility because of sin. Lewis, C.S. Lewis, called this fallen world filled with suffering the megaphone of God, perhaps implying God is the one shouting. May I take a little bit off that and suggest that this world is the siren of God, signaling to us that something is wrong. Something needs to be fixed. And that something is our sins. Well, those five, or whether you agree with that or not, are relatively straightforward. But there is a sixth cause of suffering, or at least one who allows suffering. And this is what really makes us uneasy, that God Himself sometimes uses suffering. And sometimes God and Satan use the same event for good or evil based on how we respond, that the devil uses it and intends it for our evil, for bad toward us. But God uses the same event and intends it for our good. Job chapters 1 and 2 is a powerful example of this. We don't have time to study that this morning. Another great example is found in that passage that we referred to earlier, 2 Corinthians chapter 12. If you turn back there with me. We intentionally use this as one of our examples of the devil causing suffering. Because that's not the full story in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, beginning in verse 7. Read with me, please, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, beginning in verse 7. "Unless I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure." Now, twice Paul says, this was given to me for the purpose that I shouldn't be proud, that I shouldn't be exalted above measure because of everything I've seen, because of what the Spirit has given me. And yet at the same time, he calls it a messenger of Satan to buffet him. How do those two things exist together? Verse 8, "Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me," because it's a messenger of Satan. "But he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake, for when I am weak, then I am strong.'" Can you imagine how frustrating that is to the devil? He puts something in the life of Paul that he thinks is going to tear him down. And God uses it to make Paul even better. And as difficult as it is to consider, God can do the same thing in our life as well. God can use our suffering. As Joseph says in Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20, after he goes through all of that suffering at the hands of his brothers, he says in verse 20 of Genesis 50, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about this salvation for all of these people." God can use suffering for our good. And may I suggest that that does not make God cruel. It does not make God evil. Like any parent, God understands that pain and even suffering is a part of the process of growth. I've got my two little girls. I don't want to shield my daughters from all pain. Sometimes pain is necessary. But may I suggest that there is a big difference. Madison is starting to ride her bike now. She's got training wheels. We're going to take those training wheels off and she's going to have to learn how to ride her bike. And there is a big difference between me having my hand on her back and letting her go and maybe she falls, to me running beside her and pushing her to the ground. And God can use suffering for our growth, but it doesn't mean that He is cruel in doing so. I think we can see this on a limited scale, though that concept is totally contrary to our culture's view of suffering. Our culture says that suffering always leads to unhappiness, and if you suffer, you can't be happy, while pleasure always leads to happiness. And if you have pleasure, then you're going to be happy. But the fact is, we experience in America today less physical pain and suffering than virtually any people in any period of time. But are we happier than any people in any period of time? No. I would suggest in many ways we are more discontent now than we have ever been. And sometimes a little suffering is just what we need to get us where we need to be. One of the happiest times in my childhood was after our house almost burned down. That sounds crazy, doesn't it? But our house almost burned down, but they were able to salvage it, so they got to clean out all the smoke damage and take and throw a bunch of stuff away. And so that left us for several months having to live somewhere else. And we rented this little bitty, tiny Cracker Box house. We had a modest house anyway. This was probably half the square footage. And we were forced into this tiny house, no TV, no internet. I was sleeping in what was supposed to be the dining room without a door. And at first that looked pretty terrible. And yet it didn't just force us out of our home, it forced us together. And those are some of my happiest childhood memories. The same reasoning applies even if we broaden it out more generally. Go to James chapter 1 and verse 2. James chapter 1. "My brethren," James says, "count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, produces endurance. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. This suffering, these trials, they do something for us. They produce endurance and perseverance and growth in us. Romans chapter 5, if you turn there with me, Romans chapter 5 and verses 3 through 5 says the same thing. And not only that, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. Now hope does not disappoint because of the love of God which has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit who was given to us. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 8 is a personal example from the Apostle Paul of this very thing. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 8. He says to the brethren in Corinth, "For we do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened beyond measure, above strength, so that we despised even of life. Yes, we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death and does deliver us, in whom we trust that He will still deliver us. You also helping together in prayer for us, and thanks may be given by many persons on our behalf for the gift granted to us through many." Sometimes we need to be reminded that we can't fix everything ourselves, but that we have to trust in God. Not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead. We have to be refined by Him. Everything doesn't happen for a reason, but God can use anything to accomplish His purposes in our life. And that includes suffering. Gold that is refined by the fire. That's what God intends for us. Not for these things to burn us up, but to make us better. Turn to Romans chapter 8, if you would. I've been struck in my preparation for this lesson how much the book of Romans deals with these ideas, especially here in the 8th chapter. Perhaps we'd be almost as well served just to read chapter 8 of the book of Romans. But notice with me Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose." All things work together for good to those who love God. I will be the first to admit, ask the high school kids how many times I say we've got to keep these verses in their context. And perhaps he is limiting it somewhat in this context to our hope, to the Spirit, to these things that they're going through, but I think sometimes we can chop this verse up to where we make it say, instead of all things work together for good to those who love God, well, all good things work together for good to those who love God. May I suggest there's more to this verse than that? Notice three things that I believe are often missed in this verse. Three keys to our understanding of Romans chapter 8 and verse 28 as it relates to our suffering and enduring that suffering. Number one, this is a promise only to those who love God, those who answer the call of His purpose. If you're not right with God, seeking to do His will in love, don't expect this assurance. You don't have this promise that all things work together for good for you. Sometimes all things are going to work together for evil because God is not there to protect you, to not allow you to be tempted beyond that which you are able to bear because you don't have this relationship with Him. This is a promise only to those who love God. Number two, he doesn't say that it is good, but that it turns out for good. All things work together for good to those who love God. Sin is still sin. Evil is still evil. And sometimes the things that happen to us, they are not good. They are wrong. But God can use those things for our good. God is great enough to use something that is wrong for our good. And then number three, please note in the text that it is not what is absolutely the best, but it is still what is good. I spent this past week in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. I stayed with a wonderful family there. And in that family, the mother of the family has a brother who was broken. He was involved in drugs and alcohol. He had mental health issues. He wouldn't take his medications. He ended up losing his life, being homeless because of those issues. What would have been best in the situation? Well, what would have been best from a God who desires all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth is if he were healthy, if he were a faithful Christian headed for heaven even today. But that's not what happened. Instead, God uses what did happen, which wasn't best, but can still be used for good. And I was so impressed by this family that God uses that trial for good in their influence, in their example, in the advice that they have for others in a similar situation. And whether it's providential or not that I was preaching this lesson, there was somebody who came to them this very week and said, "This is what's happening in our family." And they were able to help them. Is that not good? I believe that it is. The book of Job wrestles with these very issues. I feel compelled to mention anytime I talk about the book of Job that I am somewhat influenced by the haunting experience of the first time I really studied that book in a class setting. It was taught by a professor that he was my favorite professor in college, if I'm being honest about it. And he was teaching that book of Job as he wasted away and ultimately lost a battle with cancer. In fact, it was the last class he ever taught. And for me personally, at the same time, my own grandfather was battling the cancer that would ultimately claim his life. And my question at the time as we studied that book was not, why do bad things happen? Why is there so much suffering in the world? My question was, why them, God? Why these two men who do so much in your kingdom? Isn't there someone less important to teaching the gospel? Or better yet, an enemy of the gospel of Christ who might be struck and died because of these diseases? And that question, why, is the most asked question at times like this. But my question is it the right question to ask? I had another professor who said, and this has always stuck with me, if the Bible doesn't give us satisfactory answers to our question, we're probably asking the wrong question. It's not a matter in the Bible of why we suffer, though some indications are given to that, even as we discussed this morning. But instead, the question of the Bible is, how do we suffer? How will I respond to suffering when it comes? Can I hold on to my faith and my integrity even if I do suffer? Even if I lose everything else, will I still hold on to God? That is what the book of Job is really about. And while it does address basically everything we've talked about thus far, this is the question that God is seeking to answer. And as we relate this back to young people, this was asked again on college campuses. If you could ask God one question, young people, this is the number one question. May I suggest that the problem many young people face, even many young Christians when they leave home and go out into the world themselves, the problem that they face when they truly experience suffering for the first time personally, maybe it's a loss, maybe it's a grief, maybe it's a bad relationship, maybe it's a financial hardship, maybe it's a health issue, whatever. And you older people who've been through a lot more, may I suggest that we shouldn't scoff at the sufferings of young people because, well, that's not as bad because it's real to them, just like our suffering is real to us. But the problem when they truly experience this suffering for the first time is not that they don't have the academic answers to philosophical paradoxes. How can God be good and yet still there is suffering? But the problem usually is that they aren't properly equipped to deal with the suffering when it invariably comes. And so suffering sometimes shipwrecks their faith. But not in the way we would expect. Not intellectually. Not hypothetically. But practically and personally. The crisis of faith associated with suffering isn't like some missile strike from the edge of the earth's atmosphere. Boom! Suffering! My faith is destroyed. The real crisis of suffering for every single one of us is like a knife fight in a back alley. It's up close. It's personal. I hurt. I suffer. And I don't know how to deal with it. I don't have the tools to do so. So what do we need to do? We need to go to the Bible. We need to find the tools. And we need to give them. Yes, to our young people, but to all of us. We need to talk about how to suffer. We need to ask hard questions that are difficult to answer. We need to wrestle with those things. And then ultimately what we do is we have to trust God. That's where we have to stop this morning. I want us next time to talk about not why is there so much suffering in the world, but how do we suffer? And I want us to use the book of Job to examine just that next week. Maybe you're here this morning and you have suffered greatly. Maybe in your life you've experienced pain and sorrow, which I cannot imagine. Maybe you, like Job, have had all taken from you at some point or another. Don't allow that to drive you from God. Allow that to drive you to Him. Because He is the one with the answers. He is the one who can provide comfort. And He is the one. He is the one who promises a place where there is no suffering. A place eternal in the heavens. If you will submit your will to His. Won't you come? Won't you put Christ on in baptism? And if you're already a Christian, if you're already a Christian and you are going through a time of suffering, know that you are not alone. But you have brothers and sisters in Christ who are here for you. And we'll pray for you. We'll pray with you. We'll do anything we can to help you. All you have to do is come. While together we stand and while we sing.